The San Francisco Experience Podcast, brought to you by Jim Herlihy. Independent commentary from a Silicon Valley perspective for a global audience, featuring newsmakers, thought leaders, and authors. Season 24, Episode 11, The Three Ages of Water, Prehistoric Past, Imperiled Present, and Hope for the Future, talking with author Dr. Peter Glick. COP28 in Dubai highlights the fact that water has shaped civilizations and empires, driven advances in science and technology from agriculture to space exploration, and progress in health and medicine. But unsustainable water use, ecological destruction, and climate change threatens this precious resource. Our conversation is timely and takes place against the backdrop of COP28, the UN climate conference, which is underway in Dubai. Our guest today is Dr. Peter Glick, co-founder and president emeritus of the Pacific Institute for Studies in Development, Environment, and Security. He joins us from his office in Oakland, California. Hello, Peter, and welcome to the show.
Hi, Jim. I'm happy to be here.
Peter, you're a recognized water sustainability expert, a hydrologist, and climatologist. In 2003, you were named as a MacArthur Fellow, and followed by 2006, you were elected to the National Academy of Sciences. You're the author of 13 books. Tell us about how you developed your interest in water and the work of the Pacific Institute.
Sure, I'd be happy to. So I am a scientist by training. I've worked for many years at the intersection of environmental challenges on the science side and policy, with a particular focus on climate change and water. And I guess I've always been interested in environmental issues. I grew up in the 60s and 70s when environmental issues were particularly coming to the fore in the United States. The environmental movement was gaining speed. There were a series of energy crises and environmental crises, and I guess that piqued my interest. And I've been trained in the sciences to look at these challenges and came out to California, went to graduate school at Berkeley in the Energy and Resources Group, where I focused on climate change and water issues. And then started the Pacific Institute, as you mentioned in the introduction. The Institute's an independent nonprofit research center in Oakland. We focus on global freshwater issues broadly and the issue of sustainability. And we look at water, water use, water sustainability, conflicts over water worldwide, the connections between water and energy, water and climate. I did some of the earliest work on the impacts of climate change on water resources in California. And I guess I'm interested in this issue because water is connected to everything we care about, the way we grow food, the way we handle our industry and our wash our clothes and wash our dishes, the way politics is in the international arena. There are just so many ways in which water is so important to us. It's just become one of my favorite things to work on.
Very impressive. Peter, from the dawn of time, water has been the fundamental building block of life. Tell us about the three ages of water.
My new book, The Three Ages of Water, is in some senses a history, the human history of water and the role that water has played really from the beginning of time, from the beginning of the creation of the Big Bang, when the first molecules of oxygen and hydrogen were created and the first water appeared. And in my book, I talk about the first age of water as being the time from the creation of water itself through the creation of our solar system and the formation of Earth and the bringing of water to our planet, and the evolution of humanity and the role that water and climate played in really the success of Homo sapiens, our species. Without our ability to successfully deal with the vagaries of nature and the vagaries and extremes of water and climate, I think Homo sapiens would never have become the dominant species that we are today. And the first age continues through the creation of the first empires. The great empires of Mesopotamia and along the Indus Valley and in early China, when we learned as a species how to manipulate the hydrologic cycle for our benefit. You know, we created writing and invented agriculture and the first irrigation. And I talk about the role that water played in all of those aspects. And that really is the first age of water. The second age of water I describe is really our age, the sort of scientific and social and cultural revolutions that permitted us to create the societies that we live in today, that brought great benefits to us. And I could talk about that, and I'm sure we will in the next few minutes, but The second age also brought unintended bad consequences, sort of the water crises and climate crises that we're seeing today. And so I call in my book for a third age of water, a transition to a more sustainable future. And I talk in the book about how to make that transition, that I believe we're in that transition, and how to move to a more positive, sustainable future for water.
Let's go back to the very beginning and to into prehistory. You mention at the outset that the story of the Great Flood is a story which spans not only the Old Testament, of course, but predates the Old Testament in that it was a story which was common throughout the Middle East, throughout the area where civilization really began. Tell us about that first story, because it's so seminal to our relationship with water that I think it's worth just taking a moment to reflect on that.
Sure. So, you know, growing up, we all, I think, learned the story of Noah and the punishment meted out by God for the sins of humanity. And Noah's warned about a great flood. That's the story that appears in the early Bibles. But in fact, that story has antecedents. That story is preceded by very similar stories from ancient Sumeria from around 3000 BC, you know, more than 5,000 years ago, where, again, very similar stories are told in the ancient Middle East about the gods and the anger of the gods about the transgressions of humans. And one flood hero, Noah or Atrahasis, or he appears in many names in these early stories, being warned by a more friendly god that these floods are coming, and builds a boat and saves animals and repopulates the world. Those stories are ubiquitous in ancient times. And it's interesting that it turns out there are also possible connections with actual real floods that occurred in the Tigris and the Euphrates rivers, the rivers of ancient Mesopotamia. And that those early flood stories may actually be tales passed down from one generation to another to warn those later generations of the damaging role of nature and the need to watch out and for damaging floods and to protect ourselves from damaging floods. They're wonderful stories when you go back into ancient history.
Once our ancient ancestors ceased to be hunter-gatherers and they settled down and started to develop agriculture, almost from the get-go, of course, the concept of irrigation became very important once our ancestors actually settled in communities and became farmers as opposed to hunter-gatherers. Tell us about those early steps of irrigation and how important that was in our relationship to water, our management of water, and the creation of our civilizations.
Well, that's right. As human populations grew, and as we expanded and developed and evolved from hunter-gatherer communities to more fixed communities, those first early communities of humanity were alongside major rivers where there was reliable water. Without reliable water, those early communities could never have survived. And as populations grew, and as we started to invent agriculture, when our early ancestors started to realize that, gee, they could cultivate some of these wild plants that they had been using for food sources, and they could make them grow in a more reliable way, then irrigation became critical. And because some of these early civilizations were in very arid areas, like the Middle East, like ancient Mesopotamia, in what is today Syria and Iraq and Iran, intentional agriculture really had to become an important part of the management of water. And we see in archaeological digs, we see the first canals being dug, the first irrigation ditches, bringing water from these more reliable rivers to lands that weren't getting the rain they needed, but needed water to grow the food to support these early empires. And that was really the beginning of agriculture and the beginning of intentional agriculture and the beginning of what even today is critically important intentional irrigation, the ability to bring water to fields when nature doesn't necessarily provide it in order to grow the food that we need.
Mm-hmm. And in addition to the development, of course, in the Mesopotamia region that we're most familiar with, of course, in the West, at the same time, in India and in China, there were parallel developments going on with water and the Indus River, the Yellow River in China. Could you tell us about developments in those regions?
Yeah, that was one of the fun things about the book. As I was researching some of these issues, the early history of the role of water with humanity, to discover that intentional agriculture began in ancient Mesopotamia, but it also began along the Indus River in southern Asia and along the major rivers, the Yangtze River and the Yellow River in China, where the first rice was cultivated and the first millet was cultivated. Again, we're talking 6, 7, 8,000 BC, many, many, many centuries and eons ago in multiple areas around the world. These early civilizations were learning how to cultivate crops, how to turn some of the wild grains that they had been collecting into more cultivated crops that could produce more and more food for, again, the growing populations. And we saw some of this, in fact, there's evidence for some of this in the early civilizations in South America as well. And again, the crops were a little different because of the way foods were distributed naturally around the world. But we see it in all of the early civilizations.
And of course, our earliest ancestors not only saw water as a great resource for agriculture, there was also a recognition that waterborne disease, or that there were certain diseases that were waterborne, and the importance and the necessity to separate out waste from potable water. Tell us a little bit about that realization.
Well, we do see in some of these early archaeological records evidence of intentional water systems being built to bring irrigation water in, but also water supply, and also to collect and remove wastes. Of course, in the first age of water, waterborne diseases were also rampant. We didn't understand what waterborne diseases were. You know, we didn't understand what diseases in general were in these early ancient civilizations. And life was pretty brutish and short for many of these cultures. You know, people didn't live very long. They died for unexpected or unexplained reasons. And in fact, the transition from the first age to the second age of water was in part driven by the need to understand some of the adverse consequences of the first age. What were water-related diseases? What were appropriate ways of getting rid of wastes that were beginning to afflict the growing populations? And of course, the second age of water was also a time when the science started to permit us to understand what water-related diseases were, and the science started to permit us to develop the technologies to collect and treat wastewater instead of just getting rid of our wastes into natural systems.
Let's move on to the second age of water, because it's the second age of water, of course, that we are closest to today, and of course, where some of the great strides in water treatment, waste management were made. Also, the realization that as Western cities were growing to hundreds of thousands, even to a million people, that their management of water was critical to maintaining an acceptable and a healthy level of life and lifestyle in urban areas. Talk to me about some of the great strides and developments that took place during the second age of water.
Yeah, so the end of the first age of water and the beginning of the second age of water was really driven by two things. One was populations outgrowing their local water sources and the need to understand what water-related diseases were and to deal with some of the crises that they were beginning to develop then. But it was also driven by scientific revolutions and the cultural revolutions and the social revolutions of the Islamic Golden Age and the Renaissance in Europe, where science started to develop and give us the tools to understand what some of these problems were. You know, we discovered what oxygen and hydrogen was. We discovered what water was. We discovered the sources of water-related diseases. The germ theory came about, and we learned, for example, in a wonderful story that's in the book, that cholera was a waterborne disease, mm-hmm. not spread as an airborne disease or spread in food. And these advances of the second age of water also led to technological advances that permitted us to treat water, to clean up water, to find the medical advances and the cures for water-related diseases. And all of those advances are the advances that we have benefited from. That's what I said earlier. The second age of water in many ways is our age of water. And those are the advances that have permitted us to build the societies that we have today.
As the second age of water unfolded, and of course the Industrial Revolution came along, in addition to the waste that society at that time was used to, human waste, animal waste, that sort of thing, there was then the phenomenon of industrial waste and chemical waste. Talk to me about that and the realization that that waste needed an extra special kind of treatment to maintain the general health of the population.
Well, of course, as populations grew in the Second Age, you know, from the first millions to billions, now 8 billion people, and as our industries and societies expanded and our industrial abilities to produce goods and services expanded, we also increased our ability to produce incredibly bad pollutants. And again, as part of the Second Age of Water, you know, we built our industries and then we typically dumped our wastes right into our waterways without either knowing or caring about the consequences of those new pollutants. And those pollutants continued to build up and they contaminated our waterways and destroyed our rivers and our lakes. And it was really those environmental problems that helped ultimately stimulate the environmental movement of the middle of the 20th century, the 1960s and the 1970s, you know, when rivers started to catch on fire and oil spills off our coasts started to contaminate our coastal areas. Those were some of the consequences of the advances of the Second Age of Water, some of the adverse consequences that now we're beginning to deal with.
As I read your book, and particularly when I got to the Second Age of Water, and of course, you relate the stories of the great advances that were made in water treatment and potable water, etc. It, in a sense, it gave me hope that even 150, 200 years ago almost, our ancestors, particularly our urban ancestors, recognized that they were poisoning themselves, that they needed to do something about it. And technology at that time, of course, wasn't as advanced as it is today, but the technology that they had was then put to use to clean water, to treat the industrial effluents that were being produced. And throughout the 19th century, they were very successful in doing that. So that, in a sense, you know, having been down this road of where society was poisoning themselves through their industrial development, their poor treatment of waste, etc., there was a realization at that point that they had to do something about it to improve their health and to prevent a greater cataclysm from happening. And they were successful in doing that. So we've been down this path before, 100, 200 years ago, and that sort of gave me some optimism about the future and the greater problems that we face today with climate change. But we've confronted big issues like that before with water, and we've been successful in treating them. What are your thoughts about that, Peter?
Well, Jim, I'm glad that the book gave you some sense of optimism. I'm an optimist, and as you said at the beginning, the subtitle of the book is Prehistoric Past, Imperiled Present, and a Hope for the Future. And it's precisely because we have the ability to both understand, to see some of the adverse consequences of the Second Age of Water, and at the same time to take actions, technological actions, engineering responses, economic responses, political responses, to try and address some of those problems. That gives me the hope that we can make this transition to a third age of water, a sustainable future for water. You know, we figured out what cholera was in the 1850s, and then we figured out the technology to clean up water supply so that our water supply wasn't contaminated any longer. And that led, as I think you mentioned, to the development of water treatment technologies for every major city in the industrialized world, where we now have the ability to provide safe and affordable and clean water to our populations. Now, again, one of the consequences of the Second Age, one of the failures, is that we don't provide safe water for everyone, but we know how to. And we have solved many of these problems, either at a small scale in particular places, and we could solve them much more broadly moving forward.
One of the points in your book is how quickly that technology, the water treatment technology, spread not only throughout the United States, throughout Western Europe, through Asia, through Latin America. There was an explosion of technology, of new technology, and that was adopted globally. Again, giving me some hope for the future that we've done it before, at least with water. Hopefully, we can do it again with some of the greater challenges that face us. But that spread of technology, there's so much discussion at this point about our concern about sharing technologies, not water treatment technologies, but other technologies, that we're afraid of sharing some of these technologies because these technologies might be used against us or might be weaponized in some respect. But leaving that aside, again, the importance of sharing technology on a global basis, as you demonstrated in this book, during the Second Age, worked for the benefit of all mankind.
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, first of all, I think it reflects a fundamental key point here, which is that clean water is important to everybody.
Yes.
It's such an important part of society. Across the political divide, there's no dispute. Everybody wants access to safe, clean, affordable water. And when we developed the technology to clean up water supply, when we learned what water-related diseases were and how to prevent them, you're absolutely right. That technology spread across the United States. It spread across the industrialized world incredibly quickly. It did not reach everybody. And one of the failures of the Second Age of Water is that there are still billions of people who don't have access to what you and I are fortunate enough to take for granted, that is safe, inexpensive, clean water. But it's not because we don't know how to do that. That's been a failure of governments and institutions and needs to be addressed moving forward.
One of the other areas that of your book that grabbed my attention was the Green Revolution. You talked about the Green Revolution and the Blue Revolution. Green Revolution, of course, during the mid-20th century when agricultural yields in many areas were boosted tremendously. And there was also a blue revolution. Talk to me about that, the green revolution and the blue revolution, because in the 1940s, when the green revolution was just beginning to get underway, there was a fear that there would not be enough food to feed the growing population. And at that point, I think you made the point in the book, the United States and Mexico at that point were not net exporters of wheat. But in fairly short order, became net exporters of wheat, not only because of the Green Revolution, but also because of the Blue Revolution.
Yeah, so in the middle of the 20th century, we were very worried, some people were worried, about our ability to continue to expand agricultural production quickly enough to match the very rapidly growing populations worldwide. And there was fear about famine and the possible risk of starvation. And we experienced what was labeled the Green Revolution, basically a revolution of an expansion of crop types and crop technologies and the distribution of agricultural chemicals, of fertilizers and pesticides that really permitted a huge advance in our ability to grow food and to avoid the massive starvation that was threatening us. But I do argue in the book that the Green Revolution was as much a revolution of irrigation technology as it was of these other agricultural technologies, that the ability to expand irrigation, and in particular to pump groundwater in places that didn't have reliable surface water, but needed reliable water supplies for expanding agriculture in Southern Asia, in India and Pakistan, in the Great Plains of the United States and the Central Valley of California, in parts of Northern China, the ability to expand irrigation using groundwater was an important part of the Green Revolution. And without that expansion of groundwater technology, I argue we would not have been able to grow enough food for today's population. And even today, probably a third of all food production worldwide comes from groundwater pumping, not from the rivers, the great rivers of the world, but from our ability to tap into aquifers and groundwater systems around the planet.
Let's move on to the third age of water, and that's the age, of course, that we inhabit today. And again, for instance, here in California, our population today is 39 million people. In 1963, it crested 18 million. So we've had a net increase of 31 million people here in California. And of course, we only get rain for what? We get rain for about 6 months of the year, and the rest of the year we're dependent on reservoirs. But California has been remarkably successful in managing its water resources, just given the limited amount of time that we get rainfall and the huge increase in population, we've had our shortcomings too. What are the lessons learned from California's management of water, both on the plus side and the negative side?
Well, let me start by saying, I think we're at the end of the second age of water. I think we're facing and in the middle of a transition to what I hope will be a more sustainable third age of water, where we address the crises of the second age, where, you know, we address the fact that we harmed so many of our aquatic ecosystems because we take water out and we contaminate them with our wastes, where we fight over water worldwide, there's conflict over water, where we're dealing with climate change, where we're dealing with a failure to provide safe water and sanitation to billions of people. Those failures of the second age of water really have to drive, in my opinion, a transition to something new, to this third age of water. In California, we've built a very comprehensive water system. You know, we have infrastructure that moves water from the north and the Sierra to the coastal areas in the south where we want it, that stores water in the winter so that we can use it in the summer. We have institutions for managing water with water rights and water, some water markets. It's a very complex system. And of course, it's not perfect by any means. We certainly have fights over water in the western U.S. as a whole and in California. But we have a strong agricultural economy. We provide safe water and sanitation to almost 40 million people, as you pointed out. Mm-hmm. And we have systems for trying to improve the failures of those systems when they don't work. We have institutions that are at least trying to do smart, innovative things to provide water for Central Valley communities that don't have it, to deal with extremes of climate, to maintain a healthy agricultural system, but also provide water for the cities. And there are plenty of smart lessons to be learned from not just California, of course, but other places around the world that are doing innovative things.
Speaking of innovative things, in the third age of water, you referenced two, I thought, cutting-edge developments. One was in Canada, the other was in New Zealand, where in both countries, the legal system actually gave legal personality, legal personhood, to rivers.
Mm-hmm.
Can you enlarge on that and explain the importance of that to our listeners? Because effectively, the legislators in Canada, the legislators of New Zealand made these two rivers, you know, essentially gave them legal rights and for them to talk to me about that, because I thought that was a very novel approach and perhaps might have application to protect our water resources here in the United States.
Well, of course, one of the greatest failures of the second age of water was that we didn't know about or we didn't care about the importance of water for ecosystems. We took the water where we wanted it. We drained rivers dry. We dammed them. They had no water rights in our legal and economic systems and institutional systems. Natural ecosystems weren't recognized for their importance. And one of the advances of the second age of water is that we are now recognizing that failure. And in the third age of water, we are going to have to protect our aquatic ecosystems. And again, there are success stories all around the world. You described the two examples where governments are starting to acknowledge the right of the natural environment to have water supply, reliable water, and clean water. In the United States, we are exploring options for providing minimum flows for rivers that we used to drain completely. And the Colorado River in the Southwest, shared by seven states and Mexico, we use the whole thing, and no water reaches the delta in a normal year. But recently, there have been some experiments to try and restore some basic flows to the mouth of the river, to the important ecosystem in the delta at the Gulf of California. We're beginning to take down some damaging dams on rivers that have destroyed salmon runs. We removed the Elwha Dam in California. We're about to remove four big dams on the Klamath River and restore some of the damaged salmon runs in recognition of the importance of the environment. And that's really the key point, that we're now beginning to recognize the value of leaving some water in the environment.
Peter, you also referred to Singapore's system of new water. And further, you talked about the water treatment systems on board the International Space Station, both the U.S. approach to water treatment and the Russian approach to water treatment. Talk to me about Singapore's experiment with new water and whether that is something which will be coming to the United States.
Well, so that's, again, an important point for the third age of water. You know, in the past, we thought about water supply as simply finding water out of rivers and draining aquifers and, you know, using the natural water resources. And we're running up against absolute limits. We can't take any more water out of some of those systems. And in fact, we have to restore some of those systems. But there are new sources of water that are available. And one of the most important ones is collecting and treating wastewater and then reusing that wastewater for whatever purpose we want. It turns out we have the technology and the ability to collect the worst quality waters and treat them to the most pure quality of water. Singapore collects and treats and reuses 95% or more of its wastewater, and some of that water is so pure that they actually use it in their semiconductor industry, which requires special ultra-pure water. It's certainly pure enough for drinking water. Israel recycles and reuses 85 or 90% of its water for agricultural purposes. Here in California, we collect about 18% of our wastewater now, and we're talking about doubling or maybe even tripling it. And it's a reliable supply of new water that could be used for groundwater recharge, for industrial uses, for agricultural uses, up to and potentially even including potable uses. And of course, you know, they do this on the space station. It's incredibly expensive and difficult to lift water up to the space station. Water is very heavy. There are systems on the space station now that collect all of the water from exhaust, from people breathing out, from the atmosphere, collect the wastewater from toilets and recycle it and reuse it. And it's incredibly pure water. And we can do the same thing here on Earth, and it would reduce pressure on the natural systems.
Peter, in the remaining few minutes of the podcast, and in light of the COP28 meeting in Dubai, what must we be doing as a society to protect our water, number one? And do you see any significant water breakthroughs coming out of COP28?
Well, so as you said, I think at the beginning, I'm a climate scientist in part by training. I've done a lot of work on the impacts of climate change on water resources. And the reality is we know that the climate's changing. We know that humans are responsible. And we also know that some of the most significant impacts will be on water resources. As temperatures go up, demand for water by crops and people goes up. We're seeing already changes in extreme events and extreme storms and extreme droughts both. Precipitation intensity is going up in some places and going down in others. Sea level is going up, and that's affecting coastal groundwater systems. I mean, there are just a lot of connections between climate and water. And I have to say, it's only recently that the climate community and the conferences of the parties, the COP meetings, have acknowledged the importance of water, both in terms of the consequences of climate change, but also the potential to integrate some of our water policies in ways that help us reduce the emissions of greenhouse gases. But now there are meetings at the COPs about water resources and about both impacts and emissions. I do think that's an advance. I think we're going to have to do a lot more to slow the rate of climate change and the impacts on our water systems. But there are ways that we can manage our energy and water systems together that both reduce the consequences, reduce the severity of climate change, and reduce the consequences of climate change for water.
Peter, where can our listeners buy a copy of your book, The Three Ages of Water?
Well, of course, I encourage you to buy a copy of the book anywhere you buy books. I prefer independent booksellers like bookshop.com, but you can buy it anywhere. And go to your local bookstore. Support your local bookstore.
For our listeners, I thoroughly commend this book to your attention. It's a very easy-to-read book. There's so much information in the book that is immediately applicable to our own lives and how we interact with water, and of course, how our ancestors interacted with water, and how sanitation and health measures of the 18th and 19th century benefit us today with our extended lifespan. There's so much information in this book, which is immediately relatable, I found myself. So thoroughly recommend it to you. Peter, how can our listeners contact you?
Well, first of all, it's been a delight to talk to you. I should correct myself. It's bookshop.org is where a lot of the online independent bookstores are. I'm reachable at glick.com, G-L-E-I-C-K.com. That's my personal website. The Institute's website, the Pacific Institute, our nonprofit research center is pacinst.org, P-A-C-I-N-S-T.org. or just look up Pacific Institute and my name in Oakland, California, and I'm easy to find.
Okay. Do you have an X handle? Does the Institute have an X handle?
The Institute does. I have to say I'm no longer participating in what used to be called Twitter. I have moved to Mastodon and other social media platforms. And I'm, again, pretty easy to find. Just look for my name.
Okay. Once again, Peter, I'd like to thank you for joining us today and shedding light on the three ages of water. Very informative. This is information, this is history that all of us need to read and to assimilate. Again, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks very much for having me.
And for our listeners, today's episode is number 478. Listen to this San Francisco Experience podcast on Apple, Spotify, Pandora, 18 platforms, with listeners in 60 countries. FeedSpot has recognized the show as a top 25 California news podcast. This has been the San Francisco Experience with your host, Jim Herlihy, coming to you from San Francisco.